plock of a tennis ball somewhere outside. Finally, George stopped, but remained hunched over the keys. I asked him about the manuscripts. "Oh, them," he said. "They're over there." He jerked his head at a stack of papers on his dresser. "Take them." "Have you read them yet?" "What?" "I don't know. A few. A couple." He kept his back to me as I crossed the room and picked up the manuscripts. "I hear you're working on that last troubadour story." "That's all of them," he said. "Okay?" When I closed the door, he started typing again. All through my dorm, I heard typewriters. Maybe it was nothing new. Maybe I just lost my filter, the way every voice around you will suddenly flood into your head, each with its own rhythm and tone. One machine went off in high, crackling bursts, like strings of cheap firecrackers. Another, even lower than George's, grumbled and surged like the engines of a ship. I tried not to listen for them. With our editor playing the possessed artist, I had to play the burger, had to act like the director of publication whose title I bore, and make sure Troubadour got to the printer in time. The deadline for presenting our last issue to Mr. Rice, the faculty advisor, was just days away. The same Monday our Hemingway stories were due. I gave myself up to reading submissions and forcing them on my fellow editors, and tried not to listen to other boys' typewriters, and typed nothing myself. We scheduled the final editorial meeting for Sunday night. I'd lobbied for Friday, but got voted down because Miss Cobb's graduating class was joining ours that night for the traditional farewell assembly. These assemblies were said to be neuronic in their carnality, like the fabled last night of an ocean crossing. And none of us questioned the truth of the stories we'd heard, since the girls weren't going to see us again, and we weren't going to see them again. Why be coy? Our regular dances were licentious enough, within the limits set by the vigilant and, of course, envious spinsters who rode shotgun at these affairs. But it was a truth repeated by all of us, and made ever truer by repetition, that at the farewell assembly, no amount of jealous virginal watchdogging would prove equal to the girls' desire to be alone with us in broom closets and steam tunnels. Nobody wanted to miss out. I didn't either, especially after I got a letter from Rain. This took me by surprise. We'd had our brief grapple at the Halloween dance, but I hadn't seen her since she tried to make off with my fountainhead on the train. And she'd certainly never sent me a letter before. It was a perfumed, chatty little piece, with no purpose except the unstated but obvious one of nailing down a partner for the assembly. She must have figured she could do worse than me, and probably would do worse if she left it to chance, as the desirables of each school had already begun pairing off through just such letters as this. I had not forgotten how it felt to dance with Rain, how she returned the pressure of my thighs and played her fingers over the back of my neck, and the then painful fact that she had immediately taken up with another boy, Jack Broom of sacred memory, after being pried away from me. The sheer impersonality of her ardor snuffed any scruples I might have felt and gave the lurid tint of revenge to my anticipations. Yet I had tried to set the editorial meeting for that night. Time was running out, and I wanted to put Troubadour to bed so I'd have the weekend to finish the story I hadn't even begun. There were other Rains in the world, but only one Ernest Hemingway. And there was another reason I had tried for Friday night. Saturday it was Purcell's day of reckoning. If he didn't show up for chapel that afternoon, he'd be long gone after dinner, when we gathered to make our picks. I wanted him there. I needed him to help me sort through this pile of submissions, in which only two poems and one story stood out as clear choices. Purcell was brutal in his judgments, but he was also shrewd, and finally willing to allow that he despised this or that manuscript rather less than the rest. The other two would be no help at all. George in favor of everything, and Bill cryptic and elusive. "There are a lot of cats in this story," he'd say. Or, "I didn't know it rained that hard in Athens." Then shrug and fall silent. Though never overtly so, his responses were much more destructive than Purcell's. They left you feeling dazed, flat-footed. It was exactly the way he played squash, never slamming the ball head-on like I did, but breezily tapping it through some sly angle, so it died in the corner. On Friday, Big Jeff made it known that if his cousin got kicked out for cutting next afternoon's chapel, he was leaving with him. I heard this at lunch and wouldn't have believed it except that our table master refused to contradict it. It made no sense. Big Jeff loved the school. Anybody could see that. He was an odd duck, and in a place less sure of itself and therefore harder on its eccentrics, he would have had some rough sledding. Here he received the protections of a holy fool, and he sensed these indulgences, if not their reason, and basked in them. It was also already plain that he would become one of those alums who return constantly to the alma mater and fatten her with bonbons from his swelling portfolio, and one day leave her so much of what his own children have been anticipating and even budgeting into their current expenses that the disappointed heirs seriously consider paupering themselves further in attempts to break a will that the old boy's office would already have bound in legal iron. So why would Big Jeff let his cousin's obstinacy and pride come between him and the school he loved? He certainly couldn't help Purcell by threatening to leave. That was ridiculous. The school was no less hostage to its rules than we were, and he knew it. Why, then? Love. Worship. This was a curious and agreeable twist. Big Jeff, spanieling after his cousin with his tongue out, barking at phantoms as he followed him into martyrdom. That somehow put the whole thing in a farcical light, as Purcell must have understood, because he was furious. First he collared Big Jeff in Blaine Hall after lunch and made some kind of scene. I wasn't there, but word got around. Then that afternoon, he came to Big Jeff's room, just down from mine, and gave him another browbeating. "This has nothing to do with you. You have no right. No right." I listened to Purcell yell and Big Jeff murmur indiscernibly in reply. Then the door slammed, and I went back to my story. So far, I'd been unable to complete even a paragraph without yanking the paper out of the machine. I was still at my post when the bell rang for dinner, and when everyone came back from dinner. All up and down the hall, I heard my classmates preparing for the farewell assembly, roaring in the showers, going from room to room to be admired in their tuxes, under the pretext of having a tie adjusted, a cummerbund cinched tight. Strange how our voices deepened and slowed when we dressed up like this. It was a kind of hysteria that made us not giddy, but deliberate. The air was festively steamy from everyone showering and smelled of Old Spice. My tux, delivered with the others that morning, hung in a closet with a stiff pleated shirt of brilliant whiteness. I laid them out on my bed with the patent leather shoes, then went back to my desk. All I needed was a good beginning, something to give me a start in the morning. The hall grew quiet as the others left. I watched them cross the quad in a long, dark line. In the ashen dusk, their shirt collars seemed to float like lights on a hazy sea. Their deep voices still reached me from the far side of the quad, carried on a breeze that smelled of mown grass and rustled in the creeper outside my window, and later brought me the sounds of Lester Lannan's orchestra and the laughter of girls. All this was a distraction at first, then faded behind a waking dream. Hemingway had chosen my story and taken a shine to me and hired me to work on the Pilar. We were cruising one afternoon with his wife Mary and a couple of their friends. The friendship seemed unaccountable. The woman was catty, and the man treated the crew rudely and boasted of his skill at fishing, all of which Hemingway endured patiently, though not without giving me a resigned look, as I served yet another round of drinks. Finally, the man's wife told him to please go catch himself a fish and shut the hell up about it. He could catch a fish here, couldn't he, Ernest? They were in the middle of the goddamned ocean, weren't they? Hemingway allowed that, in fact, they were in very good fishing grounds. You would have to be cursed, he said, not to catch a fish here. The man demurred. He was particular about his gear, and hadn't thought to bring it along today. When his wife said he could surely use Ernest's, the man said he wouldn't hear of it, thanks anyway. Now, darling, don't be such a stick, his wife said. So he was buckled into the hot seat with a pole in his hands, and sure enough he had a strike within the first few minutes. The pole bent, and the line sang out. Oh, Jesus, the man said, then grunted as the pole somehow jumped its holster and yanked him forward. A great marlin leaped high off the port side, shook itself, crashed back into the water. I'm sick, the man said. I'm going to be sick. Take the pole, Hemingway told me, then helped the man out of the seat and strapped me in. I played the fish while the man puked over the side of the boat. He refused all invitations to return to the chair. So I worked the big fellow for a couple of hours, while Hemingway stood behind me and offered counsel now and then, but mostly left the job to me. Once the marlin was played out, Mary took the pole to reel him alongside, while Hemingway and I waited to set the grapple hook and winch him up. This is an unhappy case, Hemingway said. He is a good man, who married badly, and should not drink. He was very brave in the war. We pulled up to the dock at sunset. A bunch of gawkers came over. That's some kind of monster you've got there, one of them said. Who hooked him? He did, I said, and nodded at the man. Hemingway stood beside me. You have done well today, he said. You have done very well today. When Bill White came back from the library at midnight, I still hadn't written a word. Didn't you go to the dance, he said. I was working. Bill sat on his bed and slowly unlaced his shoes, fell back and stared up at the ceiling. You can still go, he said. No point. They'll be shutting down pretty soon. Working on your story? Working on my story. You? Yeah, sure. Bill rolled onto his side and watched as I pulled the empty page from my typewriter and slipped it into my desk drawer under the full pages I'd copied from Soldier's Home. He said, I saw George coming back from the dance. George went? No kidding. I've never seen him in a tux. How'd he look? Was he in a tux? Well, I suppose he must have been. I didn't really notice. Can't blame you, I said, then added, meanly, helplessly. George makes everything look like tweed. Bill didn't answer. I guess he finished his story, I said. I guess so, Bill said. How's yours going? He said this in a worn, tender way that surprised me. We were almost at the end of our years together, and without ever fighting or deviling each other, as most other roommates did, we were farther from being friends than on our first day. We had made ourselves unknowable behind our airs and sardonic courtesies, and the one important truth I discovered about him, we'd silently agreed never to acknowledge. Many such agreements had evolved between us. no acknowledgement of who we really were, of trouble, weakness, or doubt, of our worries about the life ahead, and the sort of men we were becoming. Never. Not a word. We kept everything witty and cool until the air between us was so ironized that to say anything in earnest would have been a breach of manners, even of trust. But as young boys here, we had marked each other for friendship. I still felt the possibility, and it troubled me that we had always let it slip. Mostly I blamed Bill for not coming out from behind his polish. He'd been in the dumps for weeks, yet he wouldn't break cover and talk straight to me, though we surely had things to talk about, more than he knew. The sadder he got, the more remote. Until now. How's yours going? His question was serious. The interest behind it wearily intimate, undefended, as if he had lost whatever push it took to support his urbanity. I was so wrung out myself, so tired of all this beggarly waiting for words, that I actually felt tempted to tell him the truth, that I hadn't written anything and couldn't. Poised right on the brink, I still held back, perhaps sensing that the moment it started, once I allowed myself the comfort of his interest, I wouldn't be able to stop, that the relief of confessing this paralysis might betray me into other confessions. In some murky way, I recognized my own impatience to tear off the mask, and it spooked me. Lester Lannan's orchestra was playing Auld Lang Syne. A few voices sang raggedly along, boys and girls together. "It's going fine," I said. "Like gangbusters. Yours?" "Oh, same here. Like a house afire. Like crazy. Like nobody's business." When Purcell showed up for chapel on Saturday afternoon, he took his place on the steps and waited in line for the processional to begin, eyes dead ahead, the fierce, helpless blush on his pale, freckled neck his only response to the looks he was drawing from the younger boys and the studious inattention of the older. But as the organ sounded the first notes, he raised his voice with the rest of us. "For all the saints who from their labors rest," and marched up the aisle to his seat in the second row, without letting the words trail off, as most of us did. He sang every verse, and then sat straight and intent through the chaplain's readings and remarks. And when we were left in silence, he bowed his head and did not stir. At the end of the service, the headmaster got up to congratulate the Sixth Form Dance Committee on a successful assembly, and we all applauded, and then kept on, decorously but persistently, beyond any conceivable gratitude to the dance committee. And Purcell must have known it was for him, in celebration that he was still with us, and in tribute to his selflessness in yielding dear principle for his cousin's sake. Though he was clapping too, and looking up at the headmaster, his neck had again turned scarlet. I had my own idea about his change of heart, that it had less to do with sparing Big Jeff a painful separation from the school than with sparing himself the absurd, humiliating spectacle of Big Jeff throwing himself on Purcell's very own funeral pyre. But I applauded him with the rest for the dignity of his surrender. No winking or mugging, no holding back, no hamming it up to signal derisory assent. He had something. Purcell. Sand. Backbone. Class, I guess you could say. At the editorial meeting that night, we made our decisions without serious disagreement, until we came to the last manuscript, a story by a classmate named Buckles, who'd been submitting work all year to no effect. This story did not seem to me any better than the ones we'd rejected, and I said so. "What's it about?" George said. "I can't even tell what it's about." He said this with such violence that Purcell and Bill and I were made shy for a moment. George usually took his post at the editor's desk, but tonight he was sitting by the door, cross and itchy. "Still, this is his last shot," Bill said. "Graduation issue." "That's true," Purcell said. "It's now or never for Buckles." "The story's not that bad," Bill said. "It's not that good," I said. "Bulldog Buckles," Bill said. "Never say die. Remember that story about Geronimo?" We laughed, all but George. "The forked tongue," he said sullenly. "What?" Purcell said. "It was called the forked tongue. Let me see this one again." We watched George glance over the first page. "Just listen to this," he said. He read a few lines aloud. "Well, that's not so bad," Purcell said. "Well, there's something there," Bill said. "Come on," I said. "Oh, for Christ's sake, run the stupid thing," George said. "Who cares? It's not like the rest of this crap's about to set the world on fire." When we looked at him, he bristled and said, "Well, is it?" Of course, the answer was no. Our schoolboy journal was not going to set the world on fire. But for the past year, we'd been acting on the faith that it might, choosing and shaping every issue with the solemnity of Big Jeff designing a spaceship. So the game was over. That's what George was telling us. The prick, the spoiler. He'd somehow lost his innocence. And now he couldn't rest until we, too, had seen that our sanctum sanctorum was only a storage room. Our high purposes not worth a fart in a gale of wind. But George, of all people, what had worked this change in him? What had he been writing up in that airless room? What vein of acid knowledge had he struck? "Okay," I said. "What the hell? Let's run it." So we'd come to the end, our last issue laid to rest, albeit with a bullet in its head. The others fled the room, leaving me to order and stack the manuscripts and hand them off to the incoming editor, a fifth former who'd been sitting in on the meeting to see how it was done. He looked pretty disappointed. "Mr. Rice'll leave those first thing tomorrow," I told him. "I know." It was late, past midnight. But I was too jumpy to make another start at the story that was due later that morning. So I figured I'd warm up with a few rejection notes. Usually George took care of that. But he had apparently abandoned his duties. The office machine was a tinny portable that jumped a little every time you struck a key. I wrote three or four letters and took a break. It was tomb quiet in there, the walls soundproofed by bookcases crammed with student lit mags, the overflow stacked in precarious towers on the two file cabinets and the editor's desk. Here were the troubadours of Andover, Milton, Dobbs Ferry, Taft, St. Timothy's and St. Paul's and St. Mark's, Nottingham, Hill, Woodbury Forest, Madeira, Portsmouth Priory, Foxcroft, Kent, Emma Willard, Culver, Thatcher, Roxbury Latin, Baldwin and Lawrenceville, Miss Cobbs and Miss Fines and Miss Porter's, Petty, Hotchkiss, Pomfret, Choate. On and on and on. As director of publication, I sometimes came here to file the new arrivals, though mostly I just sat at George's desk and gloated at being in the middle of all this writing. But what sort of writing was it really? I took down a review from Andover and flipped through the stories, then looked at one from Deerfield and another from Hill. Within a few sentences, every story seemed familiar. The same stuff we ran. Mannered experiment, disillusioned portrait of family or school, all designed to show what a superior person the writer was. Were the girls any better? I picked up a copy of Contiamo, the review from Miss Cobbs. It was a back issue, 5 years old. The first story concerned the superficiality of a woman prepping her house for a bridge party. I skipped to the next, called Summer Dance. and the smirk this title provoked died on my lips after the first line. I hope nobody saw me pick up the cigarette butt off the sidewalk, but I'm all out and getting shaky, and it's a nice long one, with just a smudge of lipstick from the old bird who dropped it when her bus pulled up. I kept reading. The narrator is at a bus stop, heading home after a typing class at the Y. She smokes the butt while she waits, even when it becomes apparent that another girl has caught her in the act and is completely grossed out. I don't really care, the narrator says, because I don't know her. If I knew her, or if she was a boy, that would be different. As she smokes, she thinks up a lie to scare up some cigarette money from her mother. Another fee for supplies in the typing class. She rides the bus across the city, Columbus, and walks home through a neighborhood of brick apartment buildings. Her mother's apartment is on the third floor. It's sweltering inside. The narrator's little sister is watching TV. Her mother's in her bedroom with a headache. She calls out to the narrator, Ruth, it turns out her name is, and Ruth puts some ice in a dish towel and carries it into the darkened room. She sits on the edge of the bed, holding the ice pack to her mother's forehead, and after making some tender inquiries, slips in the lie about the typing supplies. Her mother sighs and says, "Okay, of course. Take what you need." She tells Ruth that two of her friends called, but asks her, please, not to make any plans, as she feels really awful and needs her to help with Naomi. Ruth goes into the kitchen and looks at the notepad by the phone. The first message is from a girl she grew up with. It's the second time she's called since Ruth got home for the summer, and though Ruth feels guilty for not calling her back, she knows she won't do it this time either. The other message is from Caroline Fallon, a classmate at the boarding school Ruth attends on scholarship. She dials the number immediately. The two girls make clever talk about how bored they are. Ruth calls her mother Maman and describes her indisposition in terms that make Caroline laugh. Then Caroline asks if she'd like to go to a dance at the country club that night. When Ruth hesitates, she apologizes for the late notice and says, by way of explanation, they need girls. Okay, Ruth says. I need boys. There's just one thing, Caroline says. It's so ridiculous, but anyway, can I give your name as Lewis instead of Levine? Lewis? You know, Lewis, Logan, something like that. I'm sorry, Ruthie. Club rules. I see. It's disgusting. Oh, I probably shouldn't have called you. No. That's all right. That's fine. Tell them Windsor. Windsor, you are a stitch. I mean, Ruthie Windsor. Ruth Ann Windsor. Ruth and her mother argue over her plans for the night. And Ruth handles it so deftly that her mother gets out of bed to coax her back from desolation and take in the waste of a smart old evening gown of her own that Ruth's been coveting. When she leaves the apartment, she has to stop and catch her breath. She's so heady with the relief of escape. Like getting out of Granny's hospital room. Then the dance. The convertibles in the parking lot. The Japanese lanterns along the path to the ballroom. The music. The boys. Ruth sees that the boys have noticed her. But the one who catches her notice happens also to be the boy Caroline has in her sights. His name is Colson. He and his friend Gary sit down at Ruth and Caroline's table. They're both handsome, but Gary's sort of bland and Colson's broody and smart. Too smart, really, for Caroline. And just as Ruth feels his interest shift toward her, she senses a growing restlessness in Caroline. A watchful, formless unease. Something's wrong, and Caroline doesn't yet know what it is. But she'll know soon enough if things follow their present course. And she will hate Ruth for it and drop her like a toad. Well, normally that wouldn't bother her. Ruth likes to compete with other girls. And she fancies this Coulson with his rumbly voice and hooded eyes. At any other time, she would encourage his attentions. But this isn't any other time. She's at the beginning of a long summer. One of the convertibles in the parking lot belongs to Caroline. And already Ruth has gotten used to being rescued from her hot apartment for breezy drives to movie theaters and the pool at Caroline's house. This is only the first of many dances at the club, and she wants to be invited to the rest. Caroline won't just drop her if she feels betrayed. She will make sure Coulson knows that Ruth is here tonight under false pretenses, and exactly what those pretenses are. How interested will he be then? Lousy odds, Ruth thinks. She fastens her attention on Gary. He warms to it, and Coulson withdraws moodily before resuming his languid banter with Caroline, who comes brightly to life. But Ruth is still aware of Coulson, and knows that he's aware of her. Something may yet come of it before this summer is over. Something secret where Ruth can get her own back. Even now, the current between them is so obvious to her that she can hardly believe Caroline doesn't feel it. Ruth stands and takes Gary's hand to lead him toward the dance floor. Caroline smiles up at Ruth and lifts her glass. Good. She doesn't know. Everything's okay. Everything's okay. That was the last line in the story. This story where nothing was okay. I went back to the beginning and read it again, slowly this time, feeling all the while as if my inmost vault had been smashed open and looted, and every hidden thing spread out across these pages. From the very first sentence, I was looking myself right in the face. It went beyond the obvious parallels. Where I really recognized myself was in the momentary, undramatic details of Ruth's life and habits of thought. The typing class say, what could be more ordinary than spending your summer days in a typing class at the Y? That was exactly what I'd done for part of the previous summer. Yet I'd never once mentioned it to my schoolmates, just because it was so completely ordinary and uncool. And taking a bus to get there? No character in my stories ever rode a bus. The whole thing came straight from the truthful diary I'd never kept. The typing class, the bus, the apartment. All mine. And mine, too, the calculations and stratagems. The throwing over of old friends for new. The shameless manipulation of a needy, loving parent. And the desperation to flee. Not only the need, but the love itself. Then, the sweetness of flight. The lightness and joy of escape. And yes, the almost physical attraction to privilege, the resolve to be near it at any cost. Sycophancy, lies, self-suppression, the masking of ambitions and desires, the slow, cowardly burn of resentment toward those for whose favor you have falsified yourself. Every moment of it was true. How do you begin to write truly? I went back to that first sentence. I hope nobody saw me pick up the cigarette butt off the sidewalk. It made me cringe. This was not how I would ever want to be seen. Though in my own cigarette craving I had done that very thing, and more than once. What the hell? Let's see how it felt to write it. I rolled a fresh sheet into the typewriter and started pecking it out. I hope nobody saw me. Then the keys jammed. I separated them and they jammed again. That sentence did not want to be written, but I wrote it still. And there I was, winner of the Cassidy English Prize, future protege of Lionel Trilling, bending to the sidewalk for a lipsticked butt. I'd stopped going to confession right after my mother died. Even as a young boy, I'd performed it grudgingly and with no payoff I was ever aware of. But in writing those words, I felt at least an intuition of gracious release. To strip yourself of pretense is to overthrow a hard master, the fear of giving yourself away. And in that one sentence, I gave myself away beyond all recall. Now there was nothing to do but go on. Word by word, I gave it all away. I changed Ruth's first name to mine, in order to place myself unmistakably in the frame of these acts and designs. But kept Levine, because it made unmistakable what my own last name did not. I changed the city to Seattle, Caroline to James, and brought other particulars into line. I didn't have a lot of adjusting to do. These thoughts were my thoughts, this life my own. It took a long time. The typewriter kept inching back, and as it retreated, I leaned farther and farther over the desk until the discomfort broke my trance. Then I'd have to return the machine to the starting line and get up and pace the room a while to ease my back, before bending once again to the work. I finished the story just before the bell rang for breakfast. I read it through and fixed a few typos. But otherwise, it needed no correction. It was done. Anyone who read this story would know who I was. When in Disgrace with Fortune. As I left the dining hall one morning, Mr. Ramsey took my elbow and asked if he might have a word with me. He guided me in the direction of the headmaster's garden, away from the stream of boys going to their rooms or their chores. He kept his hold on me as we walked, in what I took to be a confidential English way, so I bowed my head and looked grave. It puzzled me to be singled out like this. Though I had done well in Mr. Ramsey's class the year before, I'd kept my distance, and so had he. "You've not wasted your time here," he said. I knew that Mr. Ramsey had been on the Cassidy Prize Committee, so I thought he was referring to my Shakespeare essay. But when I thanked him, he looked annoyed and waved it off. "We are not here to talk about essays," he said. "One can imagine a world without essays. It would be a little poorer, of course, like a world without chess. But one could live in it." Mr. Ramsey let go of my elbow and stopped beside the low stone wall that ran around the garden. A skinny black squirrel with tufted ears scrambled up the wall and began chattering at us. "Stories, though. One could not live in a world without stories." "No. No, sir. Without stories, one would hardly know what world one was in. But I'm not saying this very well." Mr. Ramsey stared out over the garden. "It has to do with self-consciousness," he said. "Though I'm no believer, I find it interesting that self-consciousness is associated with the fall, nakedness and shame. Knowledge of ourselves as a thing apart and bound to die. Exile. We speak of self-consciousness as a burden or a problem, and so it is. The problem being how to use it to bring ourselves out of exile. Whereas our tendency is to lose ourselves in the distance, wouldn't you say?" The squirrel approached to within a foot of us and reared up, obviously expecting a handout. Someone had been sneaking him scraps, probably a younger boy, homesick, missing his dog. "That squirrel looks about ready to take us down," I said. "Lost in the distance," Mr. Ramsey said again. "It's a wonder we're not all barking. And of course we would be if we hadn't any way to use self-consciousness against itself, or rather against its worst inclinations, morbidity, narcissism, paranoia, grandiosity, that lot. We have somehow to turn a profit on it. Which is, I must say, exactly what that story of yours does. Summer Dance. A marvelous story. Pure magic. No? No, not magic. Alchemy. The dross of self-consciousness transformed into the gold of self-knowledge. Enough. I see I am embarrassing you. But I had to tell you, for my own sake, if not yours, what a superior piece of writing that is. I thanked Mr. Ramsey for his kind words and asked how he'd happened to read my story. I had dropped my only copy in the submission box, from which I assumed it had been forwarded to Idaho with the others. I chose the final entries, he said. Seeing my surprise, he said, "Really now, you didn't suppose we sent Mr. Ernest Hemingway every story you fellows came up with, did you? All 34 of them? Oh, no. I skimmed off the three best and sent him those, though I knew it was strictly pro forma after I'd read the first page of Summer Dance. And I was right, wasn't I? Sir? Ernest Hemingway chose your story. Hadn't any choice, really. I'm no believer, as I say, but I do believe in the existence of what one can only call gifts. Gifts without a giver, if you will, but gifts all the same. That which cannot be earned or deserved. Rewards for nothing. A scandal to the virtuous and hard-working, but there you are. I'll admit to some envy here. Ernest Hemingway chose my story? We're asking you not to say anything until it's announced in the school paper tomorrow. Didn't want to spring it on you all at once like that, out of the blue. Wanted to give you a chance to draw breath. And, of course, add a personal note of congratulations. Your story will run with my interview. Well, I was glad for the day of grace I'd been given. After my last class that afternoon, I went AWOL across the river and mucked through freshly plowed fields to the tallest of the neighboring hills, Mount Winston, as we called it. Mount Winston had been a smoker's roost when I served with that band of incorrigibles. To judge from all the butts moldering up here in the dimples and clefts of exposed shale, it still was. I paced the hilltop, exhausted, but too nervous to sit. In my classes, the blood roar in my head had rendered me nearly deaf. Most of this was explosive relief and exhilaration, yet with a thumping underpulse of dread. It was one thing to confide your hidden life to a piece of paper in an empty room, quite another to have it broadcast. A warm wind blew across the hilltop, and with it the faint cries of boys chasing balls. The school lawns and fields were a rich, unreal green against the muddy brown expanse of surrounding farmland. Between the wooded banks of the river, two shells raced upstream, oars flashing. The chapel, with its tall, crenellated bell tower and streaming pennant, looked like an engraving in a child's book. From this height it was possible to see into the dream that produced the school. Not mere English envy, but the yearning for a chivalric world apart from the din of scandal and cheap dispute, the hustles and schemes of modernity itself. As I recognized this dream, I also sensed its futility. But so what? I loved my school no less for being gallantly unequal to our appetites. More, if anything. With still a month to go to graduation, I was already damp with nostalgia. I stretched out on a slab of rock. The sun in my face and radiant warmth on my back lulled me to sleep. Then the wind cooled, and I woke with a wolfish hunger and started back. The school newspaper came out twice a month. They left it in the foyer of the dining hall so we could pick it up going into breakfast. And on these mornings, we were allowed to read at the table, our faces obscured by the open wings of the plainly named News, or bent over pages folded neatly beside high-piled plates, which most boys, perhaps from long study of their commuting fathers, could empty without a glance. The thought of sitting there while everyone read my story gave me the creeps. But I had to go. I had to see what Ernest Hemingway thought of my work. The kitchen sounds and chink of crockery gave depth to the quiet of the hall. Boys glanced up from their papers to sneak looks in my direction. I couldn't eat, but I poured myself a cup of coffee and spread the front page over my empty plate. The opening of Summer Dance ran down three columns on the left, to be continued inside. The fourth and last column contained the telephone interview with Hemingway, surmounted by our art master's caricature. Mr. Ramsey had left out his own questions, so Hemingway seemed to be speaking in monologue. "You can tell your boy there that this is pretty good work. Pretty damn good work, considering. He knows what he's writing about more than he's telling, and that's good. That's always good. He is writing cleanly and well about what he knows, and he's writing from his conscience, and that always raises the stakes. This is the story of a conscience, and that kind of story, if it's honest, always has something for another conscience to learn from, even an old wreck like mine. These are true human beings here. I mean, true on the page, though I'm guessing they are true in other ways. If they are, they will never forgive him. This I can promise. If your boy had asked me, I would have told him to wait till they were all dead. Am I kidding? Sure. Sure I am. The stories you have to write will always make someone hate your guts. If they don't, you're just producing words. Advice. Don't take advice. I never did. And don't get swell-headed. Writers are just like everyone else, only worse. Did he rewrite the story 40 times? He could throw away some stuff. I've thrown away enough in my time. The kid knows what he's writing about, and that's good. Now he should go out and know some other things to write about. But I don't mean wars, not the way you probably think I mean. You don't go to war as a tourist. War will get you killed, and dead men don't write books. Same with hunting. Same with his sauce. Take Joyce, a rummy, chained to his desk. Like to read his work out loud, pretty tenor voice. Blind as a bat. You know what his wife told me? Said he ought to go lion hunting, that it would be good for his work, and I should take him lion hunting. Can you imagine that? James Joyce lion hunting with those eyes? Maybe I should have come to think of it. Watch the sauce. The sauce kills more writers than war. Just takes longer. If you're going up against the giant killer, you'd better be damn sure you can win. Some of us can, some can't. Scott never had a chance. Poor, soft, blank. Mouth like a girl's. Between the rum and that pretty mouth and that wife of his, he never had a chance. But he didn't write drunk, not like Bill Faulkner. With Bill Faulkner, you can tell, right in the middle of a sentence, where the mash kicked in. Called me a coward once. A coward. I had to have Buck Lanham set him straight. Watch the sauce. And don't pay any attention to what the blanks say about you. They said everything about me. What the hell? They'll die. And then they'll be dead. What else? Don't talk about your writing. If you talk about your writing, you will touch something you shouldn't touch, and it'll fall apart and you will have nothing. Get up at first light and work like hell. Let your wife sleep in. It'll pay off later. Watch your blood pressure. Read. Read James Joyce and Bill Faulkner and Isaac Dinesen, that beautiful writer. Read Scott Fitzgerald. Hold on to your friends. Work like hell and make enough money to go someplace else. Some other country where the blank feds can't get at you. Did I say keep your friends? Keep your friends. Hold on to your friends. Don't lose your friends. I don't know. I guess that's it. That's the sermon for today. In another week, I would meet Ernest Hemingway and walk alone with him in the headmaster's garden. He had chosen my story and made special mention of it for everyone to read. There was no excuse for me to feel anything but joy. I knew this, sure. But what did his blood pressure or James Joyce's wife or Fitzgerald's pretty mouth or sleeping late or getting up early have to do with my story? I didn't want Ernest Hemingway's advice. I wanted his attention. True, he said I was doing pretty damn good work, but his considering sort of canceled that out. The part where he said I knew what I wrote about, that was good. That was true. So why did he have to spoil it with that business about knowing something else? Did this story need me to know something else? And what exactly should I have thrown away? An example would have been nice, if you could actually find one. The best part was about Summer Dance being a story of conscience, giving other consciences something to learn from. But why not take the obvious next step and mention the courage this kind of story required? He knew. He had to know from writing Soldier's Home and The End of Something how it felt to expose yourself like this for the sake of a story, to make it living and true. Why didn't he say so? The answer came to me as I studied the shape of the interview. Hemingway had begun by talking about my story and surely would have gone on talking about it if he hadn't been derailed into all this trivia by Mr. Ramsey's questions, now cleverly removed to make Hemingway sound like a maundering, self-important old bore with his beard and a drink. It was an injustice both to him and to me, and I resented it as I resented the prissy editing of the interview. I had a vision of Mr. Ramsey, Lolita's paladin, sworn enemy of censors everywhere, hunched over the typescript like some lip-reading Soviet goon, as he cut the guts out of Ernest Hemingway's language. Hemingway had been ill-served, and so had I. But he'd be here soon and free to talk about my story without interruption. I could wait. A hand gripped my shoulder. It was Mr. Rice. Looking thoughtfully down at me, he squeezed until it almost hurt. Then he gave a little nod and let go. "Well done, sir," he said. "A commendable effusion. And because your Mr. Hemingway had the sense to recognize it, I will try to forgive his boorish traducement of his betters. But I must warn you, I shall probably fail." "Nice job," a boy across the table said. "Yeah, it's okay," another boy said. "I read the whole thing." George Kellogg fell in with me on my way to class. At first he said nothing. We walked together, hands in our pockets, shoes scuffing on the brick walkway. "I'm disappointed, naturally," he said. "But I'm glad for you, for writing that story. To tell the truth, if I hadn't seen your name on it, I wouldn't have thought it was yours. Which goes to show what a big step you took. It's a good story, a really good story, and you should be proud of it." I thanked him and said I'd like to read his sometime. "No, you wouldn't." "Oh, come on." "No," he said. And that was all. With only weeks to go until graduation, my class was drawing close. You could see the change, our studied nonchalance, cracking and falling away like the shell of an egg. Even boys who had lived almost in exile, either by their choice or ours, were led inward by the tribal feeling that had come upon us. This was both urgent and ordinary. We had seen it happen to other classes and been told that it would happen to ours, with such tedious frequency that we became knowing and wary. But despite our knowingness, it happened anyway. I didn't want to lose my place in the circle. So, of course, I was afraid of what my schoolmates would think after reading Summer Dance. My fears came to nothing. Masters and boys alike told me pretty much what George had said, with plain goodwill and something else, something like relief, as if they'd felt all along that I was holding back and could breathe easier now that I'd spoken up. A manila envelope was leaning against the door of my room. I hefted it, a book, and carried it inside. A note scrawled on the envelope said,